my desire is to have broad-based community ownership of Montana businesses because it makes sense. These businesses are profitable, they can pay a dividend. And so that's really where our arrow is pointed, but there's a lot of interim steps between starting and getting to that end destination.
This is Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, a podcast that explores why Montana leads the nation in entrepreneurship and business startups. I'm Arnie Sherman. GoodWorks Ventures is a Missoula, Montana impact fund that invests in early stage companies. An organization with a conscience, GoodWorks only backs Montana businesses that they believe contribute to the greater good and enact positive change. Founded in 2007, GoodWorks Ventures currently has a portfolio of 35 companies in science, food, sustainability, and technology. The company is the dream of Mary Stranahan, a longtime Montana philanthropist and retired physician. A year after founding GoodWorks, Mary founded a partner organization, the High Stakes Foundation. The foundation has provided over $6 million in grants to ideas that promote equality, local agriculture, climate change solutions, and sustainable communities. 2018 saw the launch of the GoodWorks Evergreen Fund, dedicated to succession planning for Montana family businesses. Today on Can Do Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, I am joined by Dr. Mary Stranahan, who founded all these impact endeavors. We are also joined by Dawn McGee, CEO of GoodWorks Ventures and president of the High Stakes Foundation. We'll discuss rural economic development and explore how Mary and Dawn define impact investing. Production support for this Can Do podcast comes from the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. And from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. Welcome to both of you, and thank you for joining me today on Can Do. We have three things I want to start off with. I want to get a little bit of the background of GoodWorks Ventures, the High Stakes Foundation, and then your latest endeavor, the GoodWorks Evergreen Fund. So let's tackle them one at a time. Tell me about GoodWorks Ventures and how that got started.
I'm going to let Dawn talk about that because she's much more on the ground with GoodWorks Ventures than I am.
Yeah, so we started GoodWorks Ventures about 12 years ago. And as you will recall, Arnie, 12 years ago, with our biggest export from Montana was our best and brightest kids out of universities here. Montana was historically an extraction economy. And as those jobs wound down, there was really nothing for people to do. And if you wanted to seek your brighter fortune, you left Montana to go some other place. And so one of the things that we cared about was how do we invest in Montana to make it a place that's going to be sustainable in the future and is going to provide enough opportunity that our kids, if they choose to, can stay here rather than have to leave. So it was on that premise that we sort of took that. And with a collective of other people who arrived in town and across the state around the same time, built what we call an entrepreneurial ecosystem, that there's a number of players that you have to have in order to create a good entrepreneurial environment. And we just started doing things like getting lawyers to talk about what it takes to form a company, getting accountants to talk about accountant issues. We visited intellectual property rights, and we just tried to normalize the conversation and make it safe for people to conceive of being an entrepreneur here in our community. As you know, often people can only sort of recognize their potential as to what their dad or their mom did. And if you haven't seen an entrepreneur in your family, it's really a scary maneuver to think about starting something for yourself or even with a collective of people. But we try to make it safe. And then we are also the first check writers into many of our companies that exist here now. First checks in submittable, first checks in audience awards, first checks in lots of other companies that are here on the ground. And after we wrote the check, then we tried to do mentoring, helping out, introductions, anything we could do to try to help make our entrepreneurs as successful as possible.
I actually think because of Dawn's experience in her past life prior to Montana, that the mentoring was probably more important than the checks.
So that leads me to what were those experiences in your past life, Dawn?
I've had a long and varied and sordid past, Arnie.
I want to hear about it.
So I started off in New York City, my career, and I was in the garment district for a year, and I decided very quickly that was not a place I wanted to spend the rest of my life. And because I wasn't smart enough to go to econ grad school, I went to law school. And I trained up and became a lawyer in New York and did a lot of M&A work while I was there, mostly on the environmental side. But learned the sort of art of the deal, as it were, you know, that we figured out how to buy sell companies and what it took to make a successful company happen and to make a successful sale. After about 7 years of doing that, I was fairly burnt out, toasty, as one might say. And so I dropped out and went to Big Sur, California, and regained my soul over the course of 2 years by running a nonprofit organization that did all sorts of things, everything from alternatives to incarceration for kids to just drumming and dancing the sounds of the wilderness. After a couple of years in Big Sur, I wound up buying a piece of land, and I needed to figure out a way to get it financed after I bought it. And the only thing I knew how to do at that time was be a big firm lawyer or wait tables, neither of which seemed very palatable to me at the time. So I wound up, weirdly enough, getting a job in Switzerland as the general counsel for Banque Financière de la Cité. And I then learned that money moves around the globe in all sorts of fascinating ways. And was really taken by, after doing a lot of pro bono work during my time as a lawyer, that money was the driving force behind just about everything, and I decided that I wanted to shift my career to work in money. And so when I came back to the United States, this was very early on in the, quote, impact investing days, I talked to Amy Dominey from Dominey Investments and Joan Bavaria from Trillium Asset Management, both of whom advised me to continue my career as a lawyer, which I was trained in, and do more pro bono work. And I refused to accept that suggestion. So even though I didn't have a background in finance except for a broad-based macroeconomic background, I was bound and determined to figure out a way to insert myself into this money business, and not as somebody on Wall Street, but as somebody who was doing impact investing. And I was fortunate enough to have a friend and colleague who took a chance on me. He had just raised a $5 million fund and basically handed it over and said, "Here, you run this." And I said, "But I don't know how to do that." And he said, "You'll figure it out. You're smart." Because I was smart, I didn't understand what was happening at the time, which was during the initial tech boom, where people were investing and monetizing eyeballs. That made no sense to me whatsoever. And at the time, there was no books about investing. There was none of that available. This is just the beginning of internet days. You couldn't look things up. My dad sent me his old Harvard textbook on finance, which I took one look at and realized I was way over my head. But we invested in things like organic agriculture and solar energy in Honduras and Guatemala and other things that had hard assets and were real. And so when the tech boom crashed, my fund outperformed everybody's fund because we had real things. And so that was the beginning of my career. And I've since worked for two other funds and then came to work with Mary in 2007, I think.
And why did you come to work for Mary?
Well, a couple of things. I was living in Seattle and I was running a microfinance investment fund, which I had done, and I was traveling all over the globe in the back of a plane, landing in India and other places and going and talking to central bankers. And I decided that that was not how I wanted to live the next 10 years of my existence. And so a colleague and friend of mine was working with Mary to try to help her prioritize her focus areas. And between that friend and a headhunter who contacted me, they said, "Would you talk to her?" And I said, "Yeah, I don't have anything to lose. What the heck?" And I flew out and I met Mary and we had dinner at the Pearl. And I think from the get-go, both of us looked at each other and went, "Yeah, I'll do this with you for sure."
Well, that's a fascinating backstory. Mary, how did you get here?
Into Montana? I was teaching school in inner city Philadelphia. And I was about to get my butt fired for going to the school board against my principal, who had come to school drunk and beat up a kid. And he said, "I'm going to have you for lunch," because I worked for the Philadelphia school system for 20 years. And he did have me for lunch. But as punishment, this was a school without walls, he made me teach something called medical careers. So keep in mind, this is in 1970. I felt all doctors were fascist pigs. And because I was about to lose my job, I loved working one-on-one with the kids. I was teaching without any educational background whatsoever. I knew I wanted a body of knowledge, I wanted power, and I wanted a one-on-one experience. And so I actually thought of going to med school and went ahead and did it. So after my urban experience, I was looking for a place that was rural, that had mountains where you were needed. St. Ignatius fit the bill, 1981.
Fresh out of osteopathic school?
Fresh out of an internship, rotating internship. So I was a late bloomer and so decided to do my family practice residency out of the real world, which was a terrifying experience for 1 year.
And so you have this medical center in Arley, Montana, St. Ignatius, Montana.
Yes.
Rural Montana. How did that change into this philanthropic juggernaut that you're involved with?
Well, I was lucky enough to be born with a silver spoon in my mouth in Toledo, Ohio, Champion Spark Plugs. And so I actually been a participant in our family foundation called the Needmore Foundation since I was 20. So I basically lived two lives. I was a doc on an Indian reservation and a philanthropist.
Champion Spark Plug in its day was a huge company. It had more than 10,000 employees.
Oh, yeah. It was a big company. And then they sold out in somewhere in the early 80s. So that's when I got cashed out.
Sold out to, as I recall, Cooper Industries?
I think it was, yeah.
And so that gave you the corpus to begin this work. Good Works Ventures started in 2007. You launched Good Works Ventures, and then you created the High Stakes Foundation. What was that designed to do that Good Works wasn't doing?
It was philanthropic dollars as opposed to investment dollars. This whole concept came from a conference I went to called Play Big, offered by Carol Newell of Newell Rubbermaid, who lived in British Columbia. And she had invited 21 wealthy people up there on the principle, would you please get the money out the door? We are in urgent times around climate change. And she created a not-for-profit and a for-profit and built a team, excuse me, with a lot of focus in it on only British Columbia. And the story that made me decide I wanted to model that in Montana was when they negotiated the last of the temperate rainforest being preserved by putting First Nations, lumber companies, environmentalists, provincial government, and federal government all at the same table, and they put First Nations at the head of the table. And that sold me. That's it. I want to do this in Montana. We actually might be more doable than British Columbia because we're smaller.
So is it fair to say you do impact investing and also impact philanthropy at the same time? Is that fair?
It's fair to say that. Our tagline, Arnie, is that we invest in visionary people and organizations that are creating a sustainable future for Montana. And what that really means to us is we look for the bright lights who are leaders, and we're agnostic as to what they're doing, so long as they're making this place better. And we have two checkbooks that we write out of because there's various reasons for doing that. But we're just trying to, like, help the people who are helping this place.
And do we have enough of those people?
We have lots. We can always use more.
Well, that's a good combination. We have lots, but you can always use more. I like that. So last year you founded the Good Works Evergreen Fund. Tell me what that focuses on.
We started off talking about, through Good Works Ventures, started creating jobs. And it's really hard to create jobs, and particularly hard to create, you know, 10, 25, 30 jobs at a time. A lot of businesses only have one or two people. To grow and scale a business is very difficult, no matter where you are. I read in the paper that there was a person who was manufacturing tarps in Stevensville, high-end tarps for trucks and boats. What are the odds of a manufacturer of tarps in Montana in the first place? But in the second place, what the paper said was he died and 10 jobs in Stevensville disappeared overnight. And I kind of took a deep breath and we all took a look around and we went, my God, that's going to happen all over the state in the next 10 or 15 years. There are all of these small mom and pop businesses that employ between 10 and 50 people and no one really wants them. The banks won't loan on them because people don't have enough assets to buy the owner out with the whole enterprise value. You can get more with liquidation quite often. The private equity companies, fortunately, are not interested in it because they're only dropping a quarter of a million or 500,000 or even a million to the bottom line, and that's simply not big enough for private equity to bother with. So our idea with this is to buy the companies that are integral to our local and community economies, that employ more than five people, as Mary said, that basically have been profitable for the last 25 or 30 years. And our hope is that by doing this on our dime, which is what we're doing right now, we prove out that we are not crazy and that we know what we're doing and that we can actually successfully transition these businesses into next generation leadership, reinvest in some of the capital requirements, and bring sort of modern day businesses like SEO optimization, things that just aren't part of old school vocabulary to the game. And that by doing so, we can start there, then we can go raise other people's money and grow that bucket. And then once we've done that and proved it out at bigger scale, we then take it to even larger scale, meaning my big ambition is to get a CUSIP number or a bond number.
What is a CUSIP number?
CUSIP number is the thing that allows something to be traded on any platform, Ameritrade, Schwab, whoever you have a brokerage account with, and it allows unaccredited investors to participate. And my desire is to have broad-based community ownership of Montana businesses because it makes sense. These businesses are profitable. They can pay a dividend. And to me, when I've spoken about this with people in the community, everyone is like, tell me when I can do this. I have $1,000 here or I have $500 there. I'd love to own a piece of Montana businesses. And so that's really where our arrow is pointed, but there's a lot of interim steps between starting and getting to that end destination.
And I want to point out for our listeners, to be an accredited investor, you have to have a net worth of what?
A million dollars.
Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of people in the community who are doing well but don't have $1 million net worth, but what would like to be a supporter of what you're envisioning.
Exactly.
This is the democratization of our economy here in Montana, in my opinion. So anybody can take their $25 and invest in their own damn community.
And how's it going so far?
So far, really good, actually. We've bought two businesses. We have a term sheet out on a third, which will close in January. We've got our eyes on our fourth, fifth, and sixth businesses so far. The exciting thing is we don't want to just buy these businesses and leave them like without having full participation. So the first business we bought, we raised the wage to $16 an hour from what they were being paid. We got them health insurance, which was a nightmare. And we're going to offer a 401k to all our employees across the board in starting in January. And so it's really important to us that it's not just jobs, but well-paid part of the community jobs that are worth preserving.
And is it your thinking that you will continue to run these businesses yourself as part of the Evergreen portfolio, or are you going to find other people to take them over?
So it's really important to have general managers on the ground for absolutely everything we're doing because there's no way we have that extended reach. What our team is operating as is sort of like the fiscal and technology and marketing backbone. So we're providing centralized services on those items, but the day-to-day operations are under the leadership of whoever are the next general manager we hire for these businesses.
Mary, you mentioned already that the mission is to nurture and empower visionary people and organizations and to create the world we want to live in.
That's a dream. Yep.
In this day and age, there are many interpretations of the world we want to live in.
I agree.
What's yours?
A democratically run country where everybody has an equal opportunity.
And how does that operationalize itself, Dawn?
Like how it operationalizes itself, again, is in the creating really quality jobs. And, you know, the newest thing that we're talking about is making sure everyone has an educational stipend so that if they want to continue their education and do work and move up in the world, that hopefully by consolidating these companies into one bucket, we're providing opportunity for people to advance with their careers, their families, their job skills. I also think that it's really important for us that the things that we're buying are very located in place. For example, the first business we bought Don's Hardware in Hamilton, Montana, and we closed that business on Don's 80th birthday. His kids work for us. They didn't want to buy the business because they're about close to retirement age themselves, and they didn't want to take that next step to like have to run the company. And they said, besides, Dad will never get out of the business if we're in the business. So I think it's great that his kids continue to work for us. They're really like engaged. They all thought they were going to give us 6 months and then leave. But as we've added on benefits and they've seen who we are and how we operate, they've all decided to stay and like do at least another 5 years for us. And as a result of that, their assets to their community and the things that they do with their time and volunteering and their own resources, it just has a ripple effect. And as you know, if you lose one core business in a small rural community, your grocery stores do less well, your bars do less well, and it sort of starts a downward cycle where you can just have, again, sort of the evaporation of people out of small communities and not be able to retain them there.
Well, the other piece of that also is, we know what the success rate is in startups. Maybe 1 out of 10 succeed and meet anybody's expectations. But if you take an established business with 20 or 30 years and keep it in the community and reinvigorate it and help it attract new customers and clients and partners, you're growing jobs and you have a platform that has already proven its sustainability.
That's correct. It's kind of a no-brainer.
It's surprising that more people aren't doing it. We're speaking with Dr. Mary Stranahan and Dawn McGee of Good Works Ventures, Good Works Evergreen Fund, and the High Stakes Foundation. Support for this episode of Can Do is provided by the Dennis and Phyllis Washington Foundation, dedicated to investing in people to improve the quality of their lives, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans, and from Blackfoot, providing communication solutions for Montana businesses, plus opportunities like C2M Beta, an innovation lab aimed at helping startups thrive. C2MBeta.com. Let me ask you this. In working with many companies, you're working with 35 or so companies in your current portfolio. What stands out about this group to you?
They're young, for one thing.
Yeah, and they're, you know, crazy, wild idealists who have an idea that they think is going to make the world better. I'll take our first check we ever wrote to a company called TerraCycle. Their business model is they make everything out of trash. Okay, that's amazing. Well, 11 years later, as we've reached this crisis of recycling and where we can no longer export our trash just off of our continent and onto someone else's, they've all of a sudden become wildly successful because everyone wants them to take their trash. And so that company's doing quite well. And it was run by this really crazy, wild, young pothead who went to Princeton. And the reason why he got in the business was he wanted high-quality compost for his grow operation in Camden, New Jersey. He made this compost and he made it kind of a liquefied thing and he started putting it in used pop bottles and shrink wrap labeling it and using old squirt things to like sell his compost solution to other people in his community and even then nationally. So that's how it got started. And I think it takes somebody special like Mary to like look at somebody like that and say, yeah, that's got potential.
It was the marijuana story that got me.
Mary, you mentioned investing in young people, but I think you invested in Patient One, and Jeff Fee, who's running that, is in mid-career.
Well, that's true. That's
so there are some entrepreneurs out there that have the passion, the drive, that are not just age-restricted.
You're right, Arnie, and it's about good ideas.
And you're finding good ideas, right?
I think the ideas, they float through the ethos. They're like little memes that you can draw down. And really, there's good ideas everywhere all the time. And the real question is, does someone take action to put that good idea to a test? And do they all work out? No, heck no. We've got a lot of failure in our portfolio. But entrepreneurs, I can say, they all tried and they all tried their best. That's all we can ask.
Let me switch gears a minute. As women, you've been a minority in the venture world, right? Is that changing at all? You know, and if it's not, what will make it change?
We have to get rid of the corporatocracy that's dominated by white men.
I wish there were more colleagues at the table. There are some. I would call out Vicky Saunders' operation called CEO, where she's forming collectives of women in local economies that are getting together to co-invest their dollars into women-owned businesses and mentor and support them in their own communities. So I think that there is action, there's forward action in there. I think that as more women come into wealth, either through inheritance or other things, that people are taking note of what's possible. And a lot of people have said to me over time, well, you know, you've got Mary and she has assets from Champion Spark Plug, so it's so easy for you to make this change because you have a bucket of money. And then I point out some of the things that we've done that actually cost very little money. For example, part of creating this collaborative ecosystem was we started something called the Hellgate Venture Network. Now, the Hellgate Canyon is a canyon that runs through Missoula. So people often say, why did you name it that? It was named after a local place. And the Hellgate Angel Network had a branding issue, so it didn't work as well. But the Hellgate Venture Network has been a phenomenal success. We started off just inviting people and saying, we'll buy the beer and we'll host a conversation among entrepreneurs because we know you don't have anybody else to talk to. You certainly can't talk to your employees about the fact you're terrified you're not going to make payroll next Friday. And you just need colleagues and you need sort of a buff up and like help. And so we created a format, Paul Gladen and I, that our entrepreneurs come and talk, and it's only entrepreneurs who are allowed to have the podium. They speak for 10 minutes about either a solution they found that works or something that doesn't work for them. And they share out and they get Q&A and some feedback from the rest of the community. And then we go back to networking, and this is all fueled by beer. And our beer budget is $600 a year. So for $600 a year, you can create a community of more than 1,000 entrepreneurs who are really, really grateful. And every single time that I say, should we keep doing this? People come up and say, I'm so grateful. This was my way into this community. This is how I found my colleagues, my job, my relationship, my house, my everything. And so just by hosting something and creating community, you can do a world of good in your own community.
Mary, getting rid of the white men in the venture business isn't that easy. Is there a way to just help move more women into the field?
Well, I think if we elected Elizabeth Warren, we'd have a real inspiration of that movement on an instantaneous basis. It's going to be long term. We have to get to the universities, the business schools. How many women are coming into your grad programs? Stuff like that. We have to hold our institutions accountable for fairness.
When you went to medical school, how many women went to medical school?
I think we were about 10% of the population in my class.
You had talked earlier, Dawn, about following the money. A few weeks ago, Jamie Dimon, you know, from J.P. Mm-hmm. Morgan Chase, was on 60 Minutes, and he said that they trade on their own trading floors $6 trillion a day. How does that kind of top of the pyramid, you know, affect what you're trying to do? So much money controlled by so few institutions.
So when I told you about starting Global Partners with John Harrington back in 1995, we've been doing this work since that time. And for 30 years, I've always just said, why isn't there more money in impact investing? It's way more fun of a game than the one they're playing. And the ability to do huge measures of good is with dollars that pale in comparison to that kind of thing. So how you do it is you start in the place that you are and you care about deeply about the place that you live and you start to just take action where you are. I don't know how you do it at the scale of that kind of trillions of dollars. And, you know, impact investing has been so co-opted. Morgan Stanley has their impact arm and so does everybody else. And they, quote, do impact investing, which means they may put a screen on companies they're trading and they're probably trading the other side on their own floors against whoever they're buying for their institutional clients. So that kind of impact investing, I don't like it. It's not making change fast enough and it's not making the kind of change that we need to make. But I think you'll see resiliency through all sectors of our economy. And if you particularly look at post-apocalyptic economies like Detroit, and you will see that just small amounts of dollars have created huge amounts of amazing change in Detroit and other places where they've been unresourced. Small amounts of resources can make those differences in recreating an economy which is a just economy and an inclusive economy and a sustainable economy.
So, ironic you mentioned Detroit because that's one of the places that Jamie Dimon and his impact investing is targeted. They're putting several hundred million dollars into Detroit. It's not a bad thing, but
$200 million. He just bumped it up again.
Great. Yeah. And, you know, good. Yay. Thank you. If Jamie wants to come to Montana and invest $200 million in Montana, I have got projects that need funding.
Let me ask you this. Do you coordinate, collaborate investment with other groups like MoFi or people that have tax credits? I mean, do you kind of bundle with someone else or do you pick your own path and then other people kind of follow what you're doing?
So As Mary mentioned, there's models for this. There's other people doing models all over the country. I'm part of an organization called Common Future, which basically hosts fellowships for entrepreneurs who are on the ground. Here in Montana, we can call out lots of people like Sarah, who runs Red Ants Pants, and other people who are doing really crazy, radical things in Montana. I would say our state's small enough that if you leave and go to a conference, you can usually see people from Montana that you otherwise never get to see, and you can cross-collaborate. I will leave it to Mary to talk about the fact that she wrote $1 million check to MoFi before it was MoFi.
I want to hear that story because when we had Dave Glazer on, he mentioned that the origins of MoFi were as a women's investment fund. So tell me about that.
I believe that was Rosalie Kate's idea, and it was the Missoula CDC at that time. And she had hired Dave and Heidi at that time as underlings. And they came up and said, if we're stuck with having to raise money every year because we can't break even in this business, we have to get bigger in order to break even. And I drank the Kool-Aid. And that was my first big contribution. And I think Dave has talked about it being leveraged about 50 times or something.
Yes.
I don't know for sure what the leverage, but it's big.
What needs to be happening in Montana that isn't happening now? You're putting money into 35 things or other people doing something, but what's not happening that needs to happen?
I don't think we're getting good policy out of our government. And I think if we got better leadership and better legislative policy made, we could make this environment so much richer than it is now. I really think our leaders are not forward thinking and retroactive, and it's hurting our entire state.
It almost reminds me of in the founding days of Montana, the challenge between sheep herders and cattle ranchers. We have that going on, even here in Missoula with Nick Chakota wanting to do his new development here in town, and the people that love it and the people that don't like it. Your vision for Montana, what's the balance between that, the old and the new?
Well, the early days of Montana were a lot longer ago than the sheep herders and cattle, and I want to acknowledge our Aboriginal friends on that. I don't like to get stuck in the past like that. I like to keep looking forward and putting one foot in front of the other.
And I will also add to that, Arnie, that, you know, we've recognized that some of the work that we've done here in creating jobs has unintended consequences that are not good. So one of the things that we're doing to counter some of the unintended consequences of our actions is we bought a building that's behind the Good Food Store, which is a store that sells natural whole foods in our community. And it's an 18,000 square foot building. And our dream is to turn it into a nonprofit center where it will house multiple nonprofits, and they will be able to collaborate together, have fun together, work together, and have stabilized rent into the future and not lose their leasehold and be kicked out of their space yet again.
So what is Good Works Place?
So we were able to buy a building downtown for our office space, and we decided to ultimately locate our offices in the back of our building, and that left a front space with windows, and there was a kitchen, fireplace that already existed. And we decided to offer that space up to the community, and we call it Good Works Place. And it was the most strategic, unstrategic thing we've ever done, meaning we just thought, well, we have some extra space, what the heck? It's been phenomenally successful. And as somebody said to me yesterday, I think, we had no idea how much demand there was for a place like this. We host fundraisers, we host board meetings, we host conversations, trainings. It's often booked 2 or 3 times a day, 5 or 6 days a week. And we offer it to the community at no cost. We occasionally ask for larger events to recoup some of our cleaning costs. But it's just been a really phenomenal success of, again, creating a space that your people can gather together, which creates the community, which creates the action. And so we were talking about earlier, how do you do this without a lot of resources? Get a space together and buy some beer. One of the things we're planning on doing with the space in this year's strategic plan is there's a lot of new people moving to our community. And Missoula is not an easy community to, like, get to know your neighbor necessarily because they went to college here. They already have their friend group. And so we're like, wow, there's all these people that are coming here. Why don't we start hosting a wine and cheese and invite them to meet some of our nonprofit organizations so we can connect them up with board opportunities. We can connect them up with things that they're interested in and connect them up with each other so they'll have their own community here in Missoula.
Mary, what qualifies a business for investment from your fund?
That it is not an extractive industry, that it is a benefit to the community, and ultimately, of course, hopefully it is going to make it.
And you're looking for good talent, right?
Good talent, and I would say that our qualification has changed over the years. When we started 12 years ago, again, we were looking for anybody that would hire anybody. So at the time, if you had an idea that might scale and you would create jobs, that qualified as impact. I would say that that lens has gotten narrower as time has gone by and that we're looking for real people impact as opposed to just you're a technology company that's going to grow, because we have a multitude of those now, and that space has been and demand has been met. So if you're just a tech company coming in with an idea, I'm not sure that you would ring our bell. But if you're a tech company that came in with an idea of transforming rural economy through having telemedicine, for example, or something similar, that might ring our bell.
So personally, what's the future like for both of you? What's the future you envision for yourself at this point in your life, Mary?
Arnie, I'm having the time of my life by getting up every morning and saying, what kind of pot can I stir today to create good change or change that I think is good? That may not, everybody may not agree with that. Being a founder of what I think is really some creative work being done here in Montana. And then I want to maintain my tennis.
Dawn?
I'm really excited about our Evergreen project because I think it's just something that when I talk to people from other places, they say, oh, we wish we had that too. And I hope that we'll be successful enough in short order that other states will start to emulate this, because when you look in the eyes of the founder whose business you're sitting there trying to negotiate a term sheet with, and you're their only option for retirement, and you're able to say yes, it's just like profound, profound work. And so I'm deeply grateful that we have a team of people who's committed to doing that. And I feel like it's really going to work. So I'm excited.
Mary, Dawn, it's great having you on the show today. I'm excited to see what pots you're going to be stirring in the future. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Arnie.
Thank you.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs. Produced by Peter Hoag and Beth Ann Austin in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please go to mtpr.org. There you can also find previous guest contact information and content from all our shows. Join me next time when my guest will be Molly Bradford, co-founder of Gatherboard, a community events platform that puts you in charge. Once again, I'm Arnie Sherman wishing you peace and prosperity.